Veterans and Military Affairs Committee for today will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. I'm getting toward the end of the voices of the guard, which are sayings, words of soldiers and family members. This one's titled Combat, and I don't really like combat, but I'm getting down to just the very last one, so I'm going to read it. Combat. I was hanging upside down, and I was kind of bent over sideways. I hear the machine guns going off. And then I saw their boots running towards me upside down. It was like slow motion. And I could see the dust coming out of the sides of their boots as they were running. The guys, they did everything that I told them to do, and they acted without me. I was so proud of them that day. I trained the piss out of them, and a lot of times they hated my guts for it. But I knew what was going to happen sooner or later. They took over for me. They stepped up. Bill Stout was trying to pull me up through one of the doors upside down. He broke his back and cracked his pelvis in two places trying to get me out. I weighed over 320 pounds with my stuff on. Then another guy came, a guy named Chris Clark came up, and there was some steel in the way, and he bent the steel with his bare hands because he's a strong son of a gun. He's part American Indian, and he was one of my little studly machine gunner Joes. I just love that guy. They drug me over to what they call a CCP, casualty collection point. My medic had been blown through the top of the roof, and he was 20 feet or 20 meters behind the Humvee. Both his legs were broken, both compound fractures, and he was trying to stand up on his bones in the middle of the road. One of the guys got to him and dragged him to the CCP, too. They were getting shot at. The guys on the machine guns were jobbing up, dropping the people that needed to be dropped. They called in helicopters. We were out of there in 15 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Hopefully those stories are going to start coming to an end.
Yes.
For members of the public, just to kind of go through the schedule, we're going to have a public hearing and work session on HB 4063A. Then we're going to move to a work session on HB 4064, and then we're going to move into an informational meeting. We have several members that have other responsibilities as the speed of the 2012 regular session picks up. So we want to do those work sessions and public hearings first. I would point out that because of what we normally do in this committee is we do a public hearing 1 week in the normal sessions, and we do a work session the following week. And of course, I think as many of you know that are in here, we had bills referred to the committee yesterday afternoon, and it's simply the shortness of the session. The one bill that was referred to us, we'll have an amendment going into it, so it will go back to the House, and I think there'll be another opportunity for a public hearing on the far side in the other House, most likely. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 4063. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4063A provides numerous licensing bodies with discretion to substitute military training or experience for other specified requirements for purposes of registration, licensure, or certification to practice a number of professions and trades. And for the benefit of the committee members on the staff measure summary, I have put in italics the number of licensing bodies affected and the number of trades and professions involved. It requires the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to grant initial or basic teaching license to certified instructors of the Armed Forces of the United States upon proof of certification and payment of required fees in the underlying A engrossed measure. And it requires the Oregon Medical Board to permit licensed physician assistants to meet continuing education requirements with military training or experience for purposes of a license renewal. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is a dash A7 amendment in front of you, and rather than requiring the issuance of the initial or basic teaching license from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, it would permit them to have the same discretion as a number of other licensing bodies to determine whether to substitute military training or experience for a bachelor's degree in completion of specified teacher training programs.
And I understand that the amendment actually came from Representative Parrish and Representative Matthews. So,
thank you.
Parrish.
Well, for the record, I'm Julie Parrish. Represent House District 37, which is Westland and Tualatin. I serve as the vice co-chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and longtime Army wife. So, this bill, kind of a near and dear to my heart, it is a committee bill. We brought this forward. We worked on this in the interim during legislative days over the last few months. I think you probably hear some testimony. I see folks from the DOD here and others who probably want to testify on this bill. This bill is really designed to recognize the skill sets that our veterans of the armed forces have garnered experience through the experience they have had serving their military and their country. And really what we're trying to do is help folks recognize that on the civilian side, those skills actually transfer into the real world. And sometimes what we find is that soldiers have a hard time translating their work history in the military into civilian speak. We've done some things around, or we're continuing to work around how we transfer college credits, for example, or how we look at skills for jobs. We've passed legislation in the last session that said that we would give folks an interview so that they could, in public employment opportunities, so that they could actually explain their military, this is their skills. This is just one more bill that we think helps serve our veterans. When my husband came home from Iraq in 2010, about half the troops from that deployment came home to no jobs. And it's not for lack of skills, and it frankly isn't necessarily for lack of jobs. There are folks who have these skills, and to send them back into college to retrain for something that the, you know, Uncle Sam has spent a lot of money and time training them on that they are competent in seems like a waste, and particularly for folks who have a post-9/11 GI Bill that they can transfer to their families. I hear from a lot of soldiers that they don't want to use those dollars to go and spend them on themselves and retrain in something that they already have skills for. They would, you know, prefer to save those dollars for their children and or their spouse. So this preserves that resource for the family, and it recognizes their skills and training. And so Representative Matthews actually had the -7 amendment drafted so that the language in the bill for teacher licensure would be consistent with everything else. We're going to hope that as people make administrative rules around how they handle this bill, that they would go to the maximum flexibility that they can within the scope of their agency. I appreciate the fact that all of the agencies have worked very hard on finding some kind of consensus that they would look at military skills and find a way to recognize the accomplishments of our servicemen and women and get them back to full employment. Our post-9/11 vets still have extremely high unemployment compared to the rest of the national average. They're a population that struggles to find employment, and so this is a jobs bill for veterans, and it does close the employment gap for people who have served our country honorably. So I will take any questions that you have, and appreciate the work that this committee does on behalf of our veterans here in Oregon.
Question?
Thanks, Julie. Thanks to you and Representative Matthews for coming and talking to me a lot about this bill.
You like this bill.
I still have questions regarding the opposition to this bill from the teaching community.
As of Friday, I talked to Lori Wimmer, who is and I don't see anybody from the OEA here. But on Friday, I had a conversation with her that she feels that the -7s will get the job done, and that, you know, that it gives the TSPC, Teacher Standard Practice Commission, enough flexibility in their rulemaking process to get to yes. The intent here was not to put somebody who had 5 hours of training in CPR and let them teach their grade. That was never the intent. But we do have people who are certified instructors who have taught years of college-level courses and have taught years in a variety of subject matter. Those are the people that we're really trying to target with this bill. That is the legislative intent, not somebody who's had 5 hours of CPR class. So, you know, we've got a program here. We've had a program in Oregon where we officer candidate school. Those folks have to develop a lot of their own curriculum. They are, you know, just doing exactly what a college professor is doing. They have a lot of skills in teaching. Frankly, some of those folks have more years teaching than somebody who's coming right out of teaching school. And so we're trying to recognize that level of service with this bill.
And I'll take my father as an example. Although he had already graduated from Linfield with his basic teaching, whatever you call it.
Yeah, bachelor's in teaching.
Yeah, okay. But if he didn't have that, he was in the Navy, and he was chief petty officer. He was based in San Diego, where I was born. He was based in San Diego, and his whole focus was teaching.
Yep.
That's all he did for the 3 years there, and they never sent him abroad because he had that skill. I mean, yep. You know, he was good at it. So if he hadn't had that teaching, and he was a chief petty officer, this means he could then go in without getting a teaching
That's the intent. And, you know, Oregon's not plowing any new ground here. This is not a brand new thing. There are at least 6 other states who've introduced this. Other states already do this. You know, there's a program called Troops to Teachers, and they give dollars to a soldier who's looking to transition from the uniform into the classroom. And one of the things that's interesting with that is when you call the regional office at Services Oregon and you ask about those dollars, they're actually telling our Oregon troops to move to Florida to get the licensure in Florida, because Florida does have a very permissive process of recognizing skills from the military and translating them into a teaching license. And then Florida has reciprocity with other states, so they say then you can go teach in a state that has reciprocity with Florida. But essentially they're encouraging our Oregon soldiers to go somewhere else. And since that program's inception, they have dispersed $81 million to soldiers who've been interested in teaching. Oregon's share of that has only been 0.5%, so about $400,000 since that program's inception. We're not drawing down those federal dollars because the hurdles for a soldier to get into teaching in Oregon are just very high, and they don't want to go back, and quite frankly, I don't blame them, spending another $25,000, $30,000 on their education when the military has done a pretty thorough job of giving them the skills that they need to be an instructor. We're still saying that you would have to go and get your additional licensure, so if you would like to, you know, get a math endorsement or a, you know, middle school endorsement, you know, you'd still have to get the endorsements with this bill. We're not saying you can have those endorsements gratis. You'll still have to go do the work. But the Troops to Teachers dollars will cover that, and the post-9/11 GI Bill for people who have that, this will preserve that resource for their families.
Thank you, Julie.
Thanks.
Mark Sansui, General Caldwell, and Val Conley. And I don't have anybody signed up from the OEA. And they haven't talked to me at all, so.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll find someone here and we'll bring them up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Mark Sansouci. I'm the Regional Liaison for the Department of Defense for the Northwest. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and testify in support of HB 4063. Last year, with 1 million veterans unemployed and with a post-9/11 unemployment rate of 13.3% and an unemployment rate of 18 to 24-year-old veterans at 21.9%, the Department of Defense began supporting efforts in the states to ask the states to give separating service members credit so they may not be held back from finding employment or finishing a degree. According to a White House press release, just this November of 2011, announcing the Wounded Warriors Tax Credit, the administration said, "As we end the war in Iraq and wind down the war in Afghanistan, over 1 million service members are projected to leave the military between 2011 and 2016. Accordingly, there is more work to do to ensure these men and women can find jobs at home when they return. We're asking legislative leaders like you to establish policies that ensure separating service members do not have to repeat requirements completed during their military career to obtain an occupational license. Last year, 4 states enacted new laws to help grant veterans credit towards licensing. So far in this session, as of this morning, we have 24 bills in 18 other states, resembling the one before you today that we're asking you to support. It's important to us that you know we're not asking for direct licensure if it's not equivalent. In cases where the regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense for the veteran, helps them get where they're wanting to go, even if not completely, that is what we seek. We only seek credit where credit is due. A couple of other points to consider, and as alluded to by Representative Parrish, you and I have already paid for a veteran's training within the Department of Defense schools and with all the experience while in the military service, while serving our nation, just by paying our federal tax dollars. Also, the more credit given to a veteran towards a certification, the more school slots can be made available to veterans, especially in programs where, as in Oregon, there may be waiting lists for civilians to get in. In response to the White House Task Force on Veterans Employment and from passage of the VAW Act, Hire the Heroes Act of 2011, the Department of Defense is also right now working feverishly with the United States Department of Labor to link service transcripts of military occupations with private sector licensure requirements, while concurrently asking state regulatory agencies, authorities in pilot states Washington, Illinois, and Maryland to review select military occupations to determine whether the training experience are sufficient to be useful in rendering licensing credit in given occupations. As you well know, Oregon is home to thousands of veterans, including many in this legislature, and it's a desired location for separating and retiring military members when choosing where to live after they leave the military. A 2010 Defense Manpower Data Study reported that in 2010, 1,296 military members separated or retired and moved back to call Oregon home. At around 1,296 annually, you can expect that highly qualified ex-military people will continue to enjoy Oregon's quality of life, and many will choose Oregon when transitioning into civilian careers. So finally, we're asking this committee and this legislature in Oregon to join the 18 other states now in session thinking about this, along with the four that did it last year. Thank you for your support, and I stand by for any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I am here today to support House Bill 4063, which would allow various state licensing agencies to accept military training or experience as an acceptable substitution for traditional training. While House Bill 4063 is modeled on a Washington State bill constructed by the Defense Department, discussions regarding this concept in Oregon began during the 2008 Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services and became a recommendation to the legislature during the 2010 Legislative Task Force on Veterans Reintegration. The Reintegration Task Force recommended the legislature provide direct entry licensing for qualified military occupational specialties. During the 2011 regular session, ODVA asked the House Committee on Veterans Affairs to establish a work group to explore the idea of licensing military veterans whose military skills, experience, and education clearly qualified them for such licensing. The work group would have included all the stakeholders so that everyone could agree as to what was doable and where compromises needed to be implemented. Unfortunately, in the flurry of activity that happens around sine die, the work group was not officially established, although the House committee supported the idea. Thus, ODVA did not move forward with this concept and instead sought to reestablish the work group during interim committees. During the November 2011 interim hearings, Mr. Sansusi testified to his success in passing legislation in Washington. The House Veterans Committee was impressed and asked Mr. Sansusi to work with committee staff to draft a bill for February, which is House Bill 4063. As you can imagine, we are excited about House Bill 4063. We believe that many veterans have experience, skills, and education that are indeed equivalent to a licensee's requirements. For example, a combat medic who spent a year saving lives in Afghanistan would most likely be qualified to be at least an EMT-1. A military heavy equipment operator or truck driver may be qualified for those licenses. You get the idea. Our goal, of course, is to get our veterans back into the workforce as quickly as possible. Without a bill, such as House Bill 4063, these veterans may have to go back to school, spend money they don't have, and take courses they've already taken in the military just to check the box for a licensing requirement. By allowing the agencies to accept military skills and experience as equivalent, everyone wins. You may be asking yourself, how do we know what is equivalent? Luckily, the legislature solved that problem last session with the passage of Senate Bill 275. You may recall that there is an organization called the American Council on Education, ACE, that maintains a database crosswalking all military skills, experience, and education for college credit. Senate Bill 275 mandated that our Oregon community colleges use ACE to apply military credits for college. The university system already uses ACE. Because of ACE, licensing boards will know if a veteran's skills, experience, and education are indeed equivalent to their requirements. Based on what we know of ACE, which just provided the community colleges a workshop, we believe this will be a very easy process. I want to thank the committee for considering this bill during this short session. We believe this bill will make a significant difference in getting veterans back to work after their military service. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
General.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department. We support House Bill 4063A. Everything that's been needs to be said has been said. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Vicki Chamberlain, and I have two vacant seats up here. If anybody else has come in that wants to testify on this bill, we'd be happy to entertain you.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Executive Director. I'm here to support Representative Matthews' amendments and to let you know that we think we have a great process for finding equivalency for work for military personnel who have been engaged in teaching. I did want to add a little bit about troops to teachers. Until about 6 months ago, the Western Region was represented by Lee Gobb, who works in Montana, and we haven't worked closely with the Colorado office. And we have had at least two annual meetings with our troops to teacher folks and have made every attempt to help give them lists and help them get connected with military veterans who are interested in teaching. And they mentioned that it's a challenge getting money connected with them. So Joe Morgan is our new appointed representative, and while I know him, we haven't worked closely together yet, so we're making a transition. But I do want to let you know that we have established that relationship in our office, and we think it's very good, although they will acknowledge and we will acknowledge it's very difficult to get the word out to veterans that there's troop-to-teacher money available to make it through the process.
Marilyn, and I apologize for not catching.
No worries. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And in the interest of time, you have my written testimony. We just, as an agency, represented in four sections of the bill, sections 1, 27, 28, and 29. We wanted to be on the record to say that this bill is consistent with our standard practice to do equivalency evaluations in several areas of our agency. And it newly authorizes us to consider educational equivalency for our polygraph licensing program. We think the processes in place in the bill and the amendments that were made on the Senate side will allow us to do those evaluations in a timely way that will best serve the veterans. Be happy to answer questions.
Madam Vice Chair, questions? Senator Cordy?
Thank you.
Senator Olson? Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 4063A? Going once, going twice. And again, for members of the public, I apologize that we are going to the short process here in the session because of doing a work session, potential work session, and public hearing at the same time. With that, I'm going to close a public hearing on 4063A. I'm going to open a work session on 4063A, Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no revenue impact on the Angus version or the Dash 7 amendment, and no fiscal impact on the A version or the Dash 7 amendment, and no subsequent referral.
And my understanding is the A7 needs to be put in if we pass this and sent back to the House. Is that correct?
I have a question. There's no fiscal, but what if we have hundreds of veterans that need to be assessed for equivalency? I mean, it's possible.
I'd love to have that problem.
Wouldn't that be great? Well, we'll let.
And I'm inviting the OEA to come up and testify, even though we just closed the public hearing and we're in a potential work session. That's a potential here, right? Because I've been calling once, twice, second. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. I apologize. I was in another legislative meeting.
And let me apologize, because with the turbo session, that's what the House is calling it. Things are moving so fast. This did not get posted to last night, as you know.
Right.
And
well,
I apologize for that.
Thank you. We're here in support of the bill with the amendments offered by Representative Greg Matthews with respect to the Veterans Affairs bill. And I'm not sure exactly what you need to hear about it from us, but we'd be happy to talk about what the bill did as it was sent to you from the House was say that a person who is a veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces needed to show proof only of the fact that they were a certified instructor. And in our conversations with folks in the Armed Forces and retired, we learned that that certification can be as little as 10 hours of training in being an instructor, and that the classes could be anything from sniper training to something more aligned to what K-12 offers their students. But because the range is such a broad landscape, we thought that that might be insufficient to make someone qualified for an automatic TSPC basic or initial license. And so we asked for some more clarification that there would be a substantial equivalency between the training on the military side and the training and the qualifications for K-12 instruction. So the amendment that's offered is parallel to all of the other licensing equivalency language in all the other parts of the bill now. I think that was probably just an omission when it was originally drafted. And with that fix, we'd be fine with the bill.
And I appreciate that. I just would comment, and I know not in K-12, but when you get to high school or college level political science, there's not a lot of difference between sniper training and political science.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that.
So,
political science major.
Questions, Madam Vice Chair? Question?
So we're in work session?
We're in work session.
Okay. Chair, I would move the dash A7s into House Bill 4063.
Senator Romanus Enners moves the A7 into House Bill 4063A. Is there discussion? Madam Vice Chair? Senator Courtney? Senator Olson? Is there opposition? If not, the A7s are adopted into the main bill. Madam Vice Chair?
Yes. And there were no other amendments to be considered. Okay. Thank you. I move House Bill 4063 as amended with the A7s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monis Anderson moves House Bill 4063A with the A7s included to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, please call the roll.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Boquist.
Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 4063A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And considering the sniping political science attack on the floor yesterday, Senator Olson, you'll be carrying it. With that, I'm going to close the House Bill 4063A hearing, open a work session on HB 4064. Counselor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4064 has no revenue impact, has a minimal fiscal, so no statement issued, has no subsequent referral, was previously heard on the 14th. It requires the Bureau of Labor and Industries to notify Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs when they receive information from service members that they've been discriminated against based on their military service. It requires the service member's authorization to make the notification, and it defines uniformed service. It has an effective date of July 1st, 2012.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counselor, we heard this bill, I guess last week, and I believe it's quite, is that fiscal's good?
It's revenue's
good?
Revenue,
Madam Vice Chair?
We're in work session?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monson Anderson moves House Bill 4064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Madam Vice Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Discussion, Senator Courtney? And we're not waiting. Call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Excused.
Oh, yes. Vice Chair Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Boquist.
A vote. Chair votes aye. The motion passes. 4064 will go to the floor with a due pass, and I'll carry it. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session on HB 4064, and we're going to move on to an informational hearing on Millage Department budget notes. So, General Caldwell, and whoever else you're bringing with you. And I would just remind the members of the public that there are members that have other obligations, so they might be in and out during the informational hearing, which should not last that long. And I do think this will probably be the last bill meeting of this committee, but we'll have an informational hearing next week, potentially. And if you're relying on our technology, we don't have VTC.
Mr.
Yep.
I apologize for missing the vote on 4064. Could I add my vote to that?
You would have to make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Olson to vote on 4064.
Senator Montes-Anderson moves to suspend the rules to allow Senator Olson to vote on HB 4063. Is there opposition?
4064.
4064, I stand corrected. If there is none, so ordered. Your vote, please.
Aye.
For the record, Senator Olson votes aye.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Director of the Office of Emergency Management. The Oregon Military Department was directed by the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Ways and Means Committee in budget notes, and the budget note on several different items at the end of the last session. The one we're going to start off with today is a reference to 911 and the public service answering points. This committee's very familiar with, I think, that subject, but go ahead.
And I do owe the department an apology. When we started at the end of the 2011 session, we thought we were in agreement with our colleagues in Ways and Means, and there would only be one presentation, and that agreement just kind of didn't happen. So I apologize to the department because we were trying to consolidate and only do this once. And so I please accept my apology for you having to do it twice to meet the legal requirements.
Thank you. The note said, quote, the military department is directed to fulfill the direction previously given to the agency in 2009 legislature, 2010 special session, and then the emergency board to report on relative merits of the public safety answering point consolidation throughout the state with the intent of reducing redundancy and creating a more cost-efficient delivery system. If a satisfactory study is not submitted to the 2012 legislature by the military department, the legislative fiscal office is directed to contract with a firm to conduct an independent analysis of consolidating the state's public service answering point. The contract, if necessary, will be paid for by the military department using 911 revenues, end of quote. The department engaged the services of a third-party consultant, L.R. Kimball, to assist the Office of Emergency Management staff with responding to legislative requests for information surrounding the public service answering point consolidation. The L.R. Kimball study was a high-level analysis of what consolidation could look like throughout Oregon. The study is primarily focused on identifying the cost issues and the time frames associated with the consolidated 911 call-taking functions only. Due to its importance, L.R. Kimball does mention the critical aspects of dispatching services and the implications to those services resulting from consolidation. The report that we're going to go through today details the methodology of the L.R. Kimball used in the creation of this recommendation. The report then details the consolidation study. The consolidation study was made up from three components: the consolidation overview, the current emergency communications environment, and the consolidation model options. The report concludes with an analysis of pricing options as well as Kimball's final recommendations. The Kimball analysis details many of the reasons why consolidation is considered, with the primary reason being desire to improve service levels. The possibility of cost savings is included, but the analysis indicates not all consolidations results in cost savings, and when savings are achievable, the realization of the savings may not occur for several years. The analysis goes on to outline the current emergency communications environment, which shows the emergency communications tax revenue currently pays for 38% of the total operating costs of the public service answering points, with the remaining 62% being financed at the local level. Finally, L.R. Kimball categorizes PSAP operations into four components: 911 calls, administrative and or 10-digit calls, dispatch functions, and ancillary duties. The report details the current status of each of these components and the impact consolidation may have on each. The report then transitions toward the consolidation models. With that, I'm going to stop that presentation and we'll walk you through the L.R. Kimball report. The report, very detailed, very thorough. We can get you copies of it.
Yeah.
It's about 100 and some pages long, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's over 100 pages long. And with that, I'll turn to our director of our technology branch and the 911 business, which are you going to go first?
I'll go first.
My deputy director will be David Stuckey. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the deputy director for the Office of Emergency Management.
And good morning. For the record, I'm Mark Tennyson with Office of Emergency Management, the director of technology and response, which includes the state 911 program.
Well, as General Caldwell indicated here in the testimony, this was a culmination of a two-part study. The first one was on next generation, completed in March of 2011, and then the second phase on the consolidation piece itself that was completed in February, just a couple of weeks ago. This is a high-level overview culminating in consolidation and some next-gen concepts. First, definitions. The next generation itself, and that term, next generation. What next generation means is basically an IP-based delivery system to the PSAPs and then beyond. And so what we have now is a legacy system. You'll hear these terms consistently throughout. Legacy is what we have now, which is your landline router type of concept to an IP that can deliver it via data, voice, or pictures. And so the concepts here, the agency has had a long-held belief that next generation is the place that we need to be for the service levels. It is a public expectation that we believe that they want to, or they think that they can communicate to PSAPs for a cry for help via text or video. And so that's the direction in which we want to go. So we incorporated some scenarios in here in this consolidation study that both cover existing numbers of PSAPs, some changes, some recommendations, and then as well as a comparison between legacy as well as next generation. Next slide, please. So basically, this was the task of Kimball. They did a great job in analyzing this. As General Caldwell indicated, it was about 100 pages, very, very thorough. In this rush session, don't expect anyone to dive into it in great detail as we complete this, but I would encourage everyone to read this and understand that, and it's really going to set up the stage for 2013. And just for the record, everyone knows that the excise tax is sunsetting in 14, so we have a very great opportunity here in the 2013 legislative session in order to make some changes, or at least at a minimum, extend the excise, the tax itself, the 75 cents per phone instrument tax that we have in existence today.
Colonel, if you're just, and committee members, so you, I guess you understand the dual track here, and what the Colonel is saying is that the ways and means process is going along the deal about discussing consolidation, and obviously any policy piece of that has one half, and then there's the ways and means process at the other half, and we have, you know, gotten the luxury, the privilege, or the tar baby of being the interim committee that's going to lead up to the next session on the policy side of looking at the policy piece, while the ways and means looks at the other piece on the far side. Whether it goes forward or not, I don't know, but I think, as you all know, budget notes and everything else, ways and means only has certain authorities, and some policy committee gets the the distinct pleasure of dealing with this issue, and in the interim we're the one that gets that on the Senate side. So thank you very much. That's why we're having this discussion.
Great point, Chair. So we basically asked Kimball to come up with three scenarios, and they actually resulted in five, but we said look at the consolidation from the standpoint of status quo. We have 49 PSAPs in the state right now. Look at the consolidation down to one, which is more what you're familiar with in the OSP model, but there's some nuances to that, and there clearly are some differences. And then also look at the optimal number of PSAPs. And so come up with a recommendation of what you think that would look like from a consolidation perspective. Slide. As a part of this Kimball went back and they did some data gathering. The very first bullet up there is basically a web-based online tool. Kimball reported on February 7th when they presented this in front of the Joint Ways and Means Public Safety that was actually a very good response. 32 PSAPs completed the survey, 15 did some partial or almost complete, and then 2 didn't do it at all. But that is a pretty good percentage from what they have seen. And Kimball has been a very experienced agency company in looking at this types of consolidation and next generation across this nation, and so we take their opinion at heart. They also went out, and the middle bullet is they went out and did some surveys. Basically, BOIC is Portland, Bureau of Emergency Communications. Willamette Valley is the PSAP that actually serves us right now if we were to call 911. And then CECOM is in Clackamas County, and then Mount Huron, Ontario. And then they also had an opportunity to go to a couple of PSAP focus groups that existed in December. So they did get that opportunity to get some direct stakeholder feedback in the course of this consolidation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question. Say BOAC serves my area, and when they were making their site visits, did they look at each of these PSAPs to see how they are utilizing their money and if there is misappropriation, which some people feel there is in various PSAPs throughout the state? I mean, did they get into that level at all?
Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, the focus of this group was to look at the operational and strategic perspective of what a PSAP does and then what the potential consolidation effects would be. And so the use of the money, the piece of money that tied into some previous legislation that you've heard wasn't necessarily their focus.
Thank you.
So in next generation, basically, they came up with the cost analysis. And we're going to walk through each one of these scenarios, and there's 5. Next slide, please. So scenario 1 is basically status quo, 49 PSAPs plus next generation. Scenario 2 is what the one call center plus next generation. And then scenario 3 is where we're going to spend the majority of our time here this morning that covered 9 regional PSAPs as well as 70 workstations. And then scenario 4 and 5 incorporates that legacy system. And so what we've wanted to ensure we accomplished was this is what we have now, but this is what we also want to be able to draw the picture. And Kimball drew it very well on where we want to go in the future. And we'll cover each one of these scenarios in detail. So first is scenario 1. Basically, this is the existing PSAPs, 279 workstations that are currently in place. And then when it talks about new network on that second bullet and then new equipment, this is where we're basically going from an IP network to a wireline frame relay network, as well as the new equipment that it's going to take to read that type of data. And so from a cost perspective, slide please. From a cost perspective, what you see here is basically a front-end load of what it's going to cost to buy this the backbone, the IP backbone that it's going to take to transfer this data across the state, as well as the equipment itself. Now, there's some assumptions in this slide that exist in every one of these cost analysis slides. You're going to see this again in scenarios 2 through 5. And to highlight, the first thing is this column right here. That's our enhanced equipment account. As you're familiar with, there's basically 4 levels of distribution in this entire $80 million biennial program. About 60.5% goes to the PSAPs and distribution. 35%, which is what that first column represents, is the enhanced account or the equipment account it takes to buy and maintain the backbone of the 911 system. And then up to 4% goes to administrative charges within Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management. And then 0.5% up to 1% goes to Department of Revenue to actually execute the movement of these dollars across the state. And so the assumption here is right up front is that equipment account is there, the enhanced account, the money's there, and it will stay there. And so there's a lot of different variables that they just didn't go into, the excise tax continuing and some other things that we just won't mention. But this is from a baseline level. Here's the consolidation.
Yeah, the assumption was that the tax will not increase. So that's going to be static.
Flat.
And that was what we asked them to work the baseline on.
And so what you see here in this first level is if we buy up front, and that really was the piece of the phase one of this construct study was how do we get the equipment up front? We need to spend that $13 million. You need to save money in order to spend money to get this to this next generation system across our state. And so the concept here is to spend it in the first couple of years, and then you'll notice that the legacy costs dramatically decrease. And there's just some sustained costs there. And then what you wind up with, if you just convert in scenario one, you wind up with a savings of about $5 million in steady state as we move forward after we've brought in the next generation system.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
Do those numbers include what we talked about in work groups about the prepaids that do not pay into the system?
They do not.
Okay.
They're not calculated. Only what we know we have today as opposed to what might be down in the future.
Yeah. So if those came in, they would be additional funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, indeed they would be, and I think that's important to keep in mind as we draft this legislation in 13. You know, how would we utilize those funds? I mean, if you heard my previous lead-in, presently the majority of the PSAPs are totally, in total, coming to about 70% paid for by local government, 30% paid by the state for the total operations. So there's obvious need for additional dollars to relieve that local issue.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide, please. So scenario two here is what we asked Kimball to do is look at one PSAP call center for the entire state. And this is under the next generation concept again, so where people, visitors in our state can actually use data or video to ask for help. And so under this call center, under this primary call center, there are some nuances here to this. First and foremost, I'd like to draw your attention to the secondary PSAP concept. It's great that everyone can call into one center, but then how you get it to the emergency services vehicle in order to get help to that locale, and that's where a dispatch center has to occur. And so there's a potential negative here, or cost burden to the locals to still maintain that dispatch function somewhere in this state.
Yes.
And isn't there a disadvantage that if the earthquake wipes out that center, you have nothing?
That's correct.
No primary alternate contingency emergency.
That is absolutely correct.
It does, but in the cost analysis on the next slide, Chair Boquist, you'll see that this cost right here up front actually includes both a primary as well as a backup. Okay. But again, that's redundancy at two. And so, yeah. Catastrophic as you highlighted, that may or may not be enough. And so what we're looking at here is what these costs don't cover. Again, consistency in the enhanced account. Here's the front-end load of buying the next generation for a one call center. But what you don't see up here is the cost it takes for the brick and mortar. For one call center across this state, it's going to take a fairly large building. Our last consolidation occurred in Jackson County in 2009-ish, and at that point in time, it still took $7 million for the locals to buy the brick and mortar it took to consolidate this facility. But as you can see in one call center, there are some potential cost savings, but that can be the deferral to the locals is in existence. Next slide. So scenario three, here's the meat of the study. Of the 100 pages, the majority are focused on this. And so this is the construct of creating 9 regionally based PSAPs. What they did not do is they did not select specific PSAPs in mind. It was just 9 regions. And they looked at it, and there's some criteria in how they looked at this 9 and created this 9 across our state, and we'll show you here in a little bit. But the subsequent slide, next slide. Subsequent slide here talks about the benefits of consolidation, and this is the viewpoint of Kimball as it moves across. There's first sub bullet here on federal interoperability, FCC, and how we manage and focus carriers and radio communications. Second sub-bullet speaks to basically single financial models and being able to maximize those types of dollars that we have. And so there are some benefits, but understand right here down at the bottom, the word potential for long-term local cost efficiency is not necessarily the case when you start talking about consolidation and having to buy brick and mortar, et cetera. Slide. Here's some feedback from that web-based, that data gathering, that tool, both in person as well as web-based that Kimball came up with. You'll see that here's some concerns, very, very critical concerns from the survey itself. Loss of ancillary duties, right up, well, first is service levels. Degraded service levels, it is absolutely the forefront of everyone's mind to ensure that they have that service level and seconds count in delivering that emergency services vehicle to the person or crisis in need. And so ensuring that service level across the board from fire, police to EMS is there is always at the forefront of their mind. And then there's some other various concerns. Basically, right here under loss ancillary duties, you'll see in the report that, quite frankly, there are a lot of PSAPs across the state that do things other than just call taking in time of need. There's phone answering duties. They are the 24/7 facility across this state and various jurisdictions, and so there are some other things that they wind up doing. Some other great points here. Loss of control of local resources. They want to make certain that they're putting their money. So PSAPs, generally speaking, it's about an 80-20, 75-25 ratio of local support versus the state dollar. And so the local jurisdictions are providing the lion's share of what it takes to operate a PSAP across the state. Chair Bocas.
I'm just looking for what you did and not an opinion, because it's like wading into a quagmire already. There's a considerable disconnect in my district, like a hang up on the phone, between the elected officials and how they're figuring out how to do their budgets and the executors. And so when you did the surveys, I see you're talking to PSAPs, but did the survey include like mayors and county commissioners who have to provide the funds in many cases?
The web-based tool went direct to the PSAPs, Chair Boquist. But then the feedback, when this study was in draft form from about 24 January until we had to brief it, until General Caldwell briefed it at the Public Safety Committee, included all stakeholders across the board. And that included fire, police, sheriffs, AOC and LOC, and so all that feedback did get rolled back into this report.
Yeah, my only suggestion in the future, and that's because we're going to get the tar baby probably in this committee, as I said, through the deal, is that I find, I don't know, my other senators in my district, that there is a growing level of concern from, I'll say, my county commissioners who have to pass the county budget. Your experience with this, General Caldwell, when you were county commissioner, and my mayors who have to pass budgets, of saying, wow, I mean, there are so many things coming down. The feds are cutting money. The states are cutting money. I mean, where do we come up with money? And I would say that, at least in this building, it's very good to talk to the associations. But, I mean, I have a significant disconnect in what the association's position is sometimes with my mayors and county commissioners. And there's a growing choir out there of, we got to cut something, and we need to find ways to save money. So I'm just saying, maybe
Excellent.
As you go forward, you might want to be asking directly to county commissioners and mayors or whoever the budgeteers is that this other 75% of the money is coming from, because I'm sure that's who we're going to hear from on our side.
Excellent.
Yes, I'd like to follow up on that, because I do have a concern. I mean, the cities are going to have to pony up the money, and then the PSAPs can just spend it basically how they want, in a sense, because they get the set amount of money, and I think some cities are very concerned that the PSAPs are not maybe being as cost efficient as they should be, and spending money on areas that maybe the cities feel they shouldn't be spent on.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, I don't think there's any question that we're in a situation where every dollar is absolutely essential at every level of government. to perform the duties that, that the citizens want us to perform. Having said that, all the control of expenditures is essentially at the local level today. The way the law was first drafted in 1985 hasn't changed that much in one rewrite. And what it boils down to is that every city and every county has the responsibility to provide this service. And the ones that have combined, I think it's become, it's always a local user board if they're combined. Or they could be under the county or they could be under the city, depending on how they work those agreements out at the local level. I think what's occurred in some instances is that you've got these user boards that are 18, 19, 20, 20 different folks on them, and they're fire service, EMS, police, the whole shoot match. And those become a little more difficult to deal with at the local level, but yet at the end of the day, as the chairman indicated, the people that are going to have to fund the difference are going to probably be a county commissioner and or county commission or a city council. Because that's where the money is that they got to submit to make this happen. There isn't enough money in all of these circumstances to do what needs to be done. The smaller areas, however, because the law is written that they don't have to combine, they don't have to consolidate. There's other examples where you get to the smaller jurisdictions, don't have near the call volume, near the workload, and yet they can do that with the money that the state provides without any additional resources from the local government.
Follow up.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Which is the point.
So much depends on relationships between, say, cities and the PSAPs. If we're going to consolidate, could a city who just is having a real difficult time with their PSAP choose another PSAP to do its business with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, indeed they can. It's within the statutory language right now that if you choose to work out an intergovernmental agreement with somebody else, you can do it, and it's happened in many instances. Lane County has four PSAPs. Mm-hmm. The one at Oak Ridge is experiencing what was just brought up here with local monies not being available. They have, I don't think it's one March. On the 1st of March, they're going to combine their PSAP in Oak Ridge with the county or the city.
The county.
They're going to move their responsibilities over to the county, and they'll go from 4 to 3. I think as the squeeze continues, you'll see more of that. I know that
Lincoln County.
Yeah, Lincoln County is in the process of talking and working with the PSAP here in Salem to consolidate, where Polk County's already done that. And so there is this movement occurring. When we started in 1985, there were 285 public service answering points in Oregon. And by the 1st of March, there's going to be 48. And one of those is going to be on the Warm Springs Reservation, which we don't fund. So there's no money from the state going to the Warm Springs. So you'll see 47, actually, that we'll be funding from the state's resources that are part of this mix. So it's happening as we speak. I think it will continue to happen. I think there are strategies that we can, scenarios that we can come up with, as now that we have this complete data, not pieces of it, but it's all in one place, where we can bring to you in the 13 sessions some strategies that will maybe even entice these folks to consider more consolidation. As Deputy Director Stuckey mentioned, if it wasn't for the cost of building a building or remodeling a building, many of them would have already done that. In fact, just last week I had a conversation with a chief of police in Prineville, Eric Bush, and Jefferson County, Cook County are now talking in conversations with Gillum, Wheeler, and Sherman County to see if they can't do a 5-county operation. So they're discussing that for the very reasons you indicated, because the cost is getting prohibitive for everybody to have their own PSAP.
Excellent points. Back to the slides. Additional consolidation concerns from the PSAPs. Most of those are basically local in nature and local culture that pretty much describes their concerns, both in service level and what they're able to deliver to the citizens at the local level. Slide. So in the Kimball recommendation, their review, it was based on several factors. Scenario three, the optimal number, the nine regions, and then one PSAP in each nine region. Basically, this was the breakout and how they determined that, both in workload, call volume, population. We obviously have some geographic type of issues going on with our mountain ranges, both coast and Cascades. And so there was a template that they put down on the paper that discussed these regions. Obviously, a further analysis would have to be done, both in communications and other things, in order to determine that. But many of those are already naturally occurring, just as General Caldwell indicated. Slide. And here's the regions.
We might add caveat, this is not etched in stone.
Nope.
Yeah, these regions were just picked basically numerically, not opposed to cultural issues, which was brought up in the legislative or in the Ways and Means. There are some relationships that are currently exist that are common bonds that would have to be considered. But again, that would be a local decision, and we would work with the locals to come up with the lines if this was enacted.
Question. Yes. Is it just theoretically, and I understand this map is pure theory, this is like one of dozen courses of action, and this made it into the slide.
Right.
In theory, are they balanced load-wise? I mean, so if you shift from one to the other, are they kind of, would they be like, for better, nine equals? Or are we talking like two large, two mediums, four smalls, or?
Mr. Chairman, you're right. It's not balanced by perfect analysis. For instance, the North Coast number, that one has got 4.6% of the total calls in the state, whereas you drop down to Multnomah, number four. Multnomah is the one up, they got 22.9%. And then you get clear down to number nine, the Gorge, and that's 2.9% of the calls. This was based mainly on geography, what the technical capabilities that exist probably now, not in the future. So I think it's kind of a dart on a map. It's not analyzed by call volume, by anything more geography.
But I guess my assumption is, to use the military term, is that, you know, whatever comes forth in the 2013 session, you know, you're going to have at least a primary alternate contingency, so that if you lose the one in Multnomah County, there's somebody someplace that could pick it up with a lot of extra work but make it work, you know, geographically, because, you know, you guys have seen the map, you know, the whole coast is not there, and the bridges and the rest of that stuff, you know, down that center line there aren't there, and then you're looping from the south loop coming around through the dalles on the telecommunications system, and so I guess I'm driving at is
redundancy,
right?
Yeah, Chair Boquist.
If it will go wrong, it will.
Yep,
it will, and one of the features of next generation also is that capability for the backup or redundancy that we don't necessarily see exist today in the legacy system.
As an example, the main fiber line was cut in 97 with the flood we had in Tillamook County. They were wholly owned, basically. They could go north one county. They couldn't get south. And so, essentially, if there wasn't a PSAP in one of those two counties, they would have been severed from the rest of the system. So if you had a backup in Salem, that wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Because we don't have the systems, we don't have the infrastructure to make that happen.
You can transfer the call, you just can't push it back out to
dispatch.
To the dispatch function. And under next gen, you'd be moving that data through a wire, but then you also have that dispatch function of being able to communicate it somehow or another with that emergency service vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, the hope of the next generation is we're going to get beyond Vernonia 20 years later, and this time we won't need to put a ham radio operator on the helicopter.
Right.
Which we've done 20 years apart, as you know.
So. Yeah, thank God for 1935 technology, or we would have been in trouble.
We did it last month.
Sure. I know. That's why I'm raising this.
Sorry. We appreciate that 1935 technology.
Thanks for highlighting
it. It works.
Okay, next slide, please. So some key talking points here is, and again, in the in the discussion as we move forward is the call taking versus dispatching, and they're completely and totally tied. In many locales, it's the same person doing the same thing. In the larger PSAPs, it's not necessarily the case. They have a separate call taking and dispatch function existing today. In statute rule is the fact that the state through the state tax is only paying for the front half of it, not the dispatch or the back half of this. And so those pieces kind of mesh together down at the local level, and so it's clearly another talking point for 2013 and the proverbial tar baby.
Right.
But it's going to be a great discussion nonetheless, and some things that need to be fixed. And then here's where it's, Kimball starts moving into it doesn't always result in cost savings, but it can result in cost efficiency as we start bringing these regions together and moving it forward. Next slide. Scenario three, cost savings. Again, you see the front half here is the nine PSAPs, and again, that's for primary as well as a backup. But then you note these figures going up just a little bit higher. General Caldwell discussion was integrating in potentially a incentive program of some sort in order to facilitate consolidation, or at least help some of the back end support because of the what the local jurisdictions pay for. Slide, please. Scenario four and five are legacy. Not going to spend a great deal of time on it. It's basically what we have now. We don't want to be there. We want to be there somewhere in the future. Technology has changed very, very quickly in the last 15 years, and quite frankly, it's going to change here again. But in order to create a next generation system, it's not overnight. Very complicated. Very, very methodical in both how we create the data backbone as well as the equipment that gets start moving into the PSAPs themselves, and regardless of what permutation we take, whether it's 49, 9, or something in between. This legacy system, we just want to show for a screenshot of what it is now. This is one statewide under the existing system. Slide. Note these numbers pop out. It's just going to cost more money if we try and consolidate now with what we have in the existing old technology.
Question. Is this system based on wireless or cable or, you know,
Chair
all
Bokers,
the above?
Senator Morris Anderson, yes, there's VoIP cell included in the legacy system, but then under next generation, it's going to have to change as they reroute those calls into the data system. And I'd like to let our more technical expert answer that question.
Chair Boquist, Senator Monis Anderson, that exactly what Dave said. If you take a look at, I'm sorry, it's one of the previous slides, but as those costs for the legacy start to go down to around $1 million a year, the embedded telephone network begins to go away as we know it today. So central offices, tandem, all those end offices, things like that, tend to go away. Selective routers that we use today at all the PSAPs that correctly route the calls to the right PSAP, those go away as it becomes an IP-based network. So the internet protocol, sorry.
Internet.
So as we go to next gen. So as we go to next generation 911, those embedded legacy costs today go away. Certainly there's a migration period that we saw in some of the previous slides of 2 years optimal that you're paying for portions of both networks. There's some embedded costs that you would continue to pay for, which is what that $1 million really reflects on the legacy. But as you can see in the previous slides, those costs get to catch up, and then there are savings down the road going to next gen.
That's right. In our discussions last summer, we talked about the commonality of equipment. These new nine centers that you would have, would they have a commonality so that they could each discuss with each other, you know, so A could talk to B, B could talk to C, and vice versa, and all that stuff?
Yeah, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, they would. Part of the inclusion in these course actions or scenarios for next generation was new equipment as well as the new consoles it took, and so there would be a commonality. And what we had looked at, and you're familiar with this because of this your past assignments, but we'd be looking at potentially leasing right up front in order to get all that equipment out there, as opposed to piece and parcel it out. From a cost efficiency standpoint. Next slide, please. The last scenario that Kimball reviewed was scenario 5, basically the legacy system, but then under the construct of the 9 regions. And cost and practical, needed to evaluate it anyway to create 9 regional PSAPs, and then use the old systems. And it would take a lot of the old equipment in order to bot, as well as some of the old legacy systems, in order to recreate this under a regional construct. Not cost efficient. Next slide. But it's certainly possible. The short answer here is there'd be minimal differences under the assumptions that we described out previously. Slide. So basically, in summary, what we're talking about, consistent themes are improving service levels. Single most important reason to consider consolidation. You may not see cost efficiencies or cost savings, but you might see cost efficiencies. There are multiple issues that would require further analysis from the cost of building the buildings to also communications pieces. In Kimball, they looked at the communication systems, but it would require the locals and state to help develop these plans to improve this integrity. We have a number of issues that the policy, Senator Boquist, that you've mentioned many times that we'd want to discuss here as we move forward. Next generation is at the top of our list. Extending the some form of the tax would be another one, and then all the others that were aforementioned. So at this point, we'll close and leave it to questions, please.
Senator Olson, question. As we look at this consolidation and bring it down to perhaps 9, has there been any consideration in this report that of a conversation that I kind of instigated this summer about backups to backups, so that we have, you know, Washington County, Multnomah County combination could back up Multnomah County, et cetera? Is there any discussion of that in this report?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, yes. The 9 regions basically did a couple of things in some of the comments in this Kimball report. The first, they talked about these bigger PSAPs have the ability to flex and move on larger size scale incidences. And so they're better equipped to handle that surge in emergency issues that may exist across our state, as well as the ability to back up from region to region in case we had the catastrophic on the West Coast, or the Cascadia, for example.
One of the other points that you made up there was the loss of dispatching jobs. However, if you make a consolidation and you assume the same number of calls that would go into the larger area as that went into the various smaller areas, could not those dispatchers be absorbed in the bigger process and the bigger unit?
Not 100%, no.
Okay.
And I think that is one of the major local concerns. Two concerns that I think we've heard consistently, and you did too, and during our summer work sessions, was, I think, focused around the dispatch capability. And if you have a call that comes into one statewide center or even a regional center, that maybe the Maple Street in Prineville is, they dispatch to that Maple Street instead of the Maple Street in Bend. I mean, there's major concern at the local level over that inability to control that dispatch. But again, the way the law is written currently is it's a local responsibility. That's not a responsibility of the state. The state's responsibility is to have somebody help pay for somebody who takes the call. It doesn't work that way in reality, and I think that's one of the things that we've talked about through the summer meetings, that when we do reconfigure this statute, that needs to be considered, I think, as the reality that's going on today in the PSAP. We need to recognize that in the law and not bifurcate those, because it just doesn't work that way. And I think that's back to that concern of local knowledge, local understanding, et cetera. Now, I think as we look at the cost pressure that we're seeing at the local levels, I think leadership at the local levels is truly interested in finding something that will work. Maybe not one PSAP across the state. I don't think anybody's in favor of that. But I think a combination of something less than 48 is going to be that they will work toward that goal. And I see that as this report is setting out a goal. You could do it with 9, according to the certified smart people, but it may not work in every corner of the state, as we expressed at Tillamook, for example. So there are going to have to be exceptions, but I do think it's less than 48. What that number is, I don't know.
So, Just a little connection. I know we've talked a lot about the concerns about the local issue, and the PSAFs that I've been to, they have both dispatch and 911 call access at the same time. Could 911, the PSAP, live on the 30% that we pay into it and have the cities, counties, whatever agencies use their 70% to pay strictly dispatch and not 911, not the answering of the 911 calls?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't have that off the top of my head. I really don't know.
Okay.
I think
it's going to take both.
It's going to, yeah, we can look at it. I think it's something that we should look at. Again, we got disparities throughout the state because we got groups now that are 100% everything. Yeah. Call taking dispatch using state resources. But the higher the call volume, the more need, I guess, in a particular area, drives that manpower cost up because you got to have the people sitting there to take those calls. I really believe that from what I've been told from everybody that I've never run a PSAP, nor have I been a first responder, but they'll tell you almost to the person that you want the same person who took the call to dispatch that call because they have the information, they're connected, and they don't want this bifurcation, so all of a sudden, you know, you pass it off to the next guy, and that guy's got to get familiar with it to do the dispatch. I got to believe the first responders, they're the ones on the ground, so there is a time gap. So I think combining those two is absolutely essential, and we need to recognize that.
What I saw, though, General, was that and most of the PSAPs I was at, that the call came in, and then that call was subsequently transferred to either fire or police dispatch. The guy that accepted the call was not the same person that dispatched the call, and that was apparent in the many PSAPs that I was in. And so perhaps, you know, we could look at that. And the reason they did that was that there was such a volume of 911 calls that they're not certain whether it was a police dispatch or a fire or an emergency, so they would bring it in and then he would direct it to the appropriate place. And it was very quick. I mean, as soon as he put it on his computer, it came up in the fire dispatch computer, and the guy could disconnect. And I was standing right there, in Bend, when a fire was called in, and it was just within a millisecond that he had it on his computer and was able to dispatch. But that's something, you know, perhaps we could look at when we discuss this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good point.
Thank you, Chair. Question, Vice Chair? A couple
of points. I guess, just so I understand, generally speaking, we spend $80 million. The state collects $80 million in taxes. The cost is about $240 million to operate, right? Basically one-third, two-thirds, roughly along that line. So I guess that's kind of one issue, figuring out, you know, and when you say cost efficiencies, the cost efficiencies is over on their two-thirds, and the cost savings in your briefing are over on our one-third, roughly speaking, right? That's how that works. Two questions. I mean, one, it would be useful us, not now, but as whatever the plan gets farther forward, I mean, what I would term the politics of the breakdown. I mean, as you mentioned, we have hypothetically two or three or four or five counties or entities that live on the 25% or the one-third we're giving them 100%. Obviously, their position is not going to be the same as the position of the county, we'll say Multnomah, who's, you know, having to...
They're paying 80%
of theirs. And so for us at our level, you know, it's better for us to know earlier than later who's going to be calling us and saying, no, this is a really bad idea versus a really good idea. So that's kind of the politics of the breakdown. The second point I bring up is that in the event we hit a real financial crisis and hit a wall, I mean, the planning concept of, okay, somebody went broke, and I'm going to use a real example right here, and they'll ring my phone off. But, you know, we've been talking about Crook County and their financial challenges down there. But if it goes away, who picks it up, and how do we do such a consolidation like that? And I'm sure there's contingency planning going on in OEM that says if Crook County doesn't get money and suddenly there is no dispatcher 911, just like the state police is planning, what are we going to do there? The same thing. I mean, yeah. I'm hoping you're thinking, God help us if it does happen, but if one or two of the counties go broke, I mean, we still have that service, as you state. The state has to provide it, and we I guess, give up our 7 troopers here in the Capital District, and they go to Crook County or whatever it is. But
I think you mean Curry County, right?
Curry County. That's not Crook. Curry County. You're right. Crook County is perfectly fine. Curry County down in the south. But there's the contingency I'm talking about. You know, if there is a crisis and there's no volunteer consolidation and we have to say, guess what, you're consolidating, as bad as that might be, I think that's some of the contingency planning that needs to be done.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, indeed, we are looking at that. I think everybody in state government is looking at that and trying to, the what ifs. I think they're extremely challenging, and it seems to tax our abilities to actually conceptualize that given the state of our own budgets.
Right.
So I think it is a definitely a elephant in the room that we need to. Hopefully we won't have to address it, but if we do, then indeed that's exactly what will happen. I guess in the long term, if there's no first responders, you don't need a 911, right? I mean, it's I remember once as a county commissioner when we, in the 80s, when we had our budget problems, and we went down to one deputy in my county to serve papers, and oddly enough, the crime rate dropped. So
I just want you to know, on the education committee, I just because you're in the National Guard here, I was, as part of Senator Verger's bill about Oregon education on the education committee, I went in and testified, and I read an excerpt from the Oregon Blue Book, which is amazing what you read in the book that Kate Brown edits, especially on my side. And so I read this, and of course I think it's 1917, and Governor Oswald decides that, you know, he's had enough of your neck of the woods there, General, and so he mobilizes a company of the militia and sends it over with his secretary, and they take over.
The halfway.
Take over town. And the National Guard is suddenly the new police authority, enforcement, you know, enforcer of prohibition, enforcer of, you know, all kinds of other things.
It's a fascinating story indeed, because that's exactly what happened. He sent his executive secretary on the train to Baker, and then, or now Baker City.
Baker City.
And they took her up to, the guard took her up to halfway, and she seized control of the city.
That's right.
And shut down all the taverns, gambling halls, prostitution houses. He probably didn't get a lot of votes out of Baker County in this next election. I think that's the only time in state history that ever happened.
Yeah, but it's pretty amazing when you read the Blue Book, the things that we have done with our National Guard and what the state has done and what the federal government has done. So anyway, appreciate this.
Yeah. I think that was prior to the state police, too, by the way.
Right. Other topics?
Mr. Chairman, it's certainly up to you. We had done other budget notes. One was on strategic planning. And also we had one on comprehensive budgets and audits, and which, if you want to go forward, we can.
Colleagues, I think you all have copies of the budget notes that you got, and you know we're conferring with our colleagues on both sides of the chambers on the Ways and Means process, because we are the, unfortunately or fortunately, we're the policy committee that gets asked to do things, we'll say. The strategic plan, they've given us a color copy here. I know some comments have come back, and I think at our level, the strategic level is what we're looking for. I mean, the only questions that I had on it in reviewing it is, you know, that are concerns that may come back to us is future force structure. I mean, what arguments and letters are we going to be signing and sending to our congressional delegation as they realign the military, you know? Will there be an armory in Coos Bay in 5 years? And I know you don't know the answer to that, but, I mean, earlier is better as far as I think we're concerned if we have to get involved in the process of politics of the National Guard at the national level, which I think are coming. And if you want to just kind of, if you can give just an overview of what you see coming from the feds.
I'd be more than happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. Currently, as you no doubt read in the paper we watched on your iPad or the television, there's a tremendous cutting action going on at the federal level in every budget. The military is not no exception to that. The current plan on the Army is to reduce 120,000 soldiers that are currently on active duty. They're roughly 500,000 right now. They'll go down to 470, 480, right in that number. The Army National Guard is currently sitting at, in spaces, 358,000. They will, the current plan that was just released in the President's budget has the Guard, the Army Guard dropping a minor amount, about 5,000 spaces. The policy of the administration, as it's stated right now, is that the National Guard, both the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, are good bargains, including the reserve forces, the Army Reserve and the Air Force Reserve, that they're good bargains with respect to the amount of money that the federal government pays. They have a very competent force after the last 8 years of war and considerable investment that has improved the capability of these reserve forces, that they believe that this is a smarter economic move to cut the active duty forces that cost you 24/7 and go to the Guard and Reserve. We endorse that opinion. We have for a number of years that this is, in some senses, around 30 cents on the dollar. Air Guard's a little higher, closer to 40 cents on the dollar to keep a Air Guard unit up as opposed to an active duty unit of similar size and capability. The issue that is primary in our eyes right now is the Air National Guard. The Air Force has taken the stance that they're going to reduce the Air National Guard considerably. Their plan right now is that somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 flying units will be taken out of service. Airplanes will be parked. For example, all the A-10s, which is a close combat air support aircraft, every single one in the Guard would be parked, basically put in the boneyard, and those units would be disbanded.
Mr. Chair, are you talking about Oregon?
No, ma'am. I'm talking about nationally. Here in Oregon, we have two flying units, one F-15 unit in Portland that has the Air Sovereignty Alert program, which is 24/7. That fighter wing protects everything from north of the Canadian or the U.S. border with Canada down to the northern part of California to do intercept on anything that's flying there that shouldn't be there. One would think that would be a fairly important mission. There's five of these units across the United States, and they call it the five corners, where they place them geographically so they can reach a potential threat within a matter of minutes, which we can do. Also, there's a reserve air refueling unit that's in Spokane, actually Guard and Reserve and active duty combined in Spokane, so when our jets launch, they launch, and then we can get fuel, because you burn a lot of fuel when you go fast. So they have to, so it's combined that way, which is a good program. So one would think that we would be fairly stable. Having said that, however, it never ceases to amaze me how the active duty Air Force and the Army, to a lesser extent in this round, but certainly the active duty Air Force can talk their way out of these important geographic givens, that we live in a place where we're at the corner of the continental United States. So would they move that unit? Possibly. We would think not, because of a lot of other factors, but that is a concern of ours. The second flying unit we have is in Klamath Falls, and Klamath Falls is Kingsley Airfield, which is the only F-15 training base in the United States right now. We train both active duty and Guard pilots at Klamath Falls. We're blessed again for geography because of the airspace that we have in south central Oregon, also into Nevada, and then also we have airspace to fly to train our pilots over the ocean. So we've got close proximity to all these airspaces. They're ideal for this kind of training, and Klamath Falls is the proper place for that. Unfortunately, when you get into the politics, sometimes they say, well, Oregon's got two flying units, and we're going to lose flying units in Ohio. You know, we won't have any, so we got to be equitable. Well, again, we have geography. We're blessed with that geography, sometimes cursed by it, but most often blessed by it. So we still think that will remain. We don't think there's a rational reason to change that. But when you look at what the Air Guard is facing right now, they're coming up with schemes against this Air Force plan to reduce the size of units inside of these wings. In other words, if you've got a wing that says you've got 1,000 people, we're going to have you reduce just some numerical value of 15%, for instance. So you take out 150 spaces, because we're going to move those to some place that lost their units, and then we'll take them from another place, and so on and so forth. We are against that. We think that's the wrong approach to solve this problem. Our position is that you get far better bang for the buck for the taxpayers if you cut active duty than you do the Guard. There are 64 National Guard Air National Guard bases in the country. If you wanted to maintain them today at their current monetary values, you could close one active duty air base anywhere in the United States, and it would fund all 64 of the Guard bases. But that doesn't seem to resonate well inside the Pentagon. So that is the biggest battle that we see coming in this reorganization that we're going to go through. We do not anticipate that we're going to see, we know we're going to see some reductions in the Army Guard because our level of deployments are starting to drop, as we've all noticed. So there's going to be less emphasis on the on those aspects. Having said that, however, the Army Guard is also moving to what is known as a operational reserve, as opposed to a strategic reserve. If we go back 20 years ago, we were funded as a strategic reserve, which meant we were getting about 15-20%, maybe as much as 25% of what it would cost to run a like unit on the active duty. But the theory was that we've got 6 months to a year to get these soldiers out of their current situation, get them more training, newer equipment, and then we can send them off to the war zone. That was where we were when the war started, and suddenly that didn't work, and everybody realized that. We had soldiers going to Iraq initially, in Afghanistan, that didn't have the latest body armor, for instance. Our equipment, we went to that war with what we had, we took our equipment with us, and you recall those discussions several years back. We literally had no vehicles here to do domestic missions. We were going to the boneyard at Fort Lewis, taking vehicles out of the boneyard, fixing them up just so we could do our domestic state mission, like fighting fires or floods. We're blessed now the Congress recognized that and said we're going to make sure that the Guard has the latest, greatest equipment. They spent a ton of money doing it, and we have the best equipment we've ever had in my 40 years of doing this. We have the best soldiers that I've ever seen. We've never had a better group of soldiers. So I think that is, with the money that was spent, we are truly an operational reserve, which means we can go quicker. If they need us, we can go quicker, and we believe that's the right approach. We do everything we can to our congressional delegation to encourage them to endorse that approach. So, one, the taxpayers save money because you can cut the active duty more, and two, you got a viable entity that is capable of doing any job that the active duty can do with very little time spinning them up, something on the order of 30 to 45 days instead of 6 months or a year. So that's the shift. That's where the Army's going. They've endorsed that. We think that's going to work well for us here. Again, though, even with that, without doing deployments, you're going to see the money shrink. There's no question about that. Right now, it's shrunk probably 15%, 20% from a year ago. But this is a work in progress. As you well know, the wars have never been on the budget. They've been off budget. And so that diffuses what you really, when you see money come to the Guard and Reserve or any other entity, is it coming from the off-budget money that they supplementals that they submit to Congress, or is it in the base budget? And that has skewed our numbers considerably. If you look at our money charge, just how much money comes in, they've kind of gone up and down and up and down, and it's all dependent on what we're doing, what we're tasked with, and where that money comes from. So it's confusing, to say the least. But in the big picture, strategically, we believe that we're going to be solid on the Army side, and we're going to have to fight really hard on the air side.
And for Senator Mona Sanderson and your colleagues up in Portland, I think it's less than 5 years ago, the argument of eliminating the Portland Air National Guard base was on the chopping block.
Correct.
5 years ago. So the Air Force is likely to do something similar.
The best description I can give you on that was a cartoon by Jack Oman in the Oregonian, and it had a cartoon of fighter jets on every corner of the United States map. Had a guy with an umbrella in the Northwest, and I think that summed it up about as well as you can sum it up. The plan was to actually do that alert out of Sacramento, mm-hmm. which was bizarre. We were totally confused. The committee, I guess, give them credit for what their job was, the Base Realignment and Closure Committee. They looked at it to a person and said, this doesn't make any sense. Why would we do this? And it was all about cutting iron, what we call iron airplanes, and cutting spaces out of the Air Guard, not the Air Force. So they're right back to their old habits. They can't prevent it. The other reduction, as you look at the department in total, is we're seeing a huge reduction from the Department of Homeland Security with respect to grants and other funds that primarily, almost exclusively, local government has used to shore up their homeland security needs, not only in personnel, but in equipment. And you might want to just touch on that.
I would like to touch, because in the last Homeland Security Council, some of the numbers were startling.
Well, one more time for the record, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and Chair Boquist, members of the committee. What we've seen here for 2012 is another 50% reduction from 2011. It was announced on Friday by Department of Homeland Security. We're at roughly $2.8 million in the Homeland Security grant that helps feed a lot of different things across the state, from emergency operations planning to reverse 911 to all kinds of different studies and architecture and communications that it takes to help develop a homeland security footprint and emergency management footprint. You may recall that in the mid-2000s, 2003, 4, 5, Oregon would get a base award of in excess of $30 million. We're now down to 2.8. The UASI region, which is the Urban Area Security Initiative, which is the city of Portland, and those contiguous counties around the city of Portland, have also gotten a base award simultaneously to the state. So you see something going to UASI, you see something going to the state of Oregon. Their grant for 2012 is now $2.1 million. Now, the future. So it got bad this year. The future for 2013 is even uglier. They just sprinkled out some of the potential grant changes that are going to be coming here in the future. 18 different grants are going to be consolidated in 2013. They have not given us the full vision, but here's what we do know. It's going to probably be less money, and it's going to be nationally competed. And so you're going to find in urban area security initiatives, the UASI region will probably go away to high threat security regions. So is Portland going to be able to compete with Chicago, New York, Los Angeles? We expect it to be worse. The only nugget of positive growth here is in the EMPG, the Emergency Management Performance Grant, and that is the base structure grant that you get in each state to help pay for 50% of an emergency manager. And it's a hard cash match. And so what we do is we help fund half of an emergency manager across this state. Several jurisdictions have multiple EMPG representatives. And that particular grant is actually increased just a little bit at the federal level as well as the state level. All other grants, they're going down.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm still confused. Do you think that because we have such a low population of people that they want to take it away and put it where if there were enemy strikes, rather than some kind of tsunami or earthquake, that more people will be affected in California, and they think that's better?
Well, Chair Boquist, Senator Mona Sanderson, what we're going to see here for 2013 is threat-based analysis. And so we're going to have to prove, as well as everyone else across this nation, under this threat-based analysis, what it is, what our gaps are. And that's where the competition is going to exist, to see where those jurisdictions that bubble to the top are the ones that truly have that threat. We have seen these threats exist in a terrorism nature in the city of Portland. So we may or may not be able to compete, but we're gonna have to prove it. In order to get it. It's no longer going to be a base award that here you get it, now mm-hmm. go out and execute.
Yeah, I think the recent example at the Capitol building where this wannabe terrorist in the FBI was working with it was just in the news last week. I think when you look at the country as a whole and the population centers, there are certain factors that they're evaluating, which is things like, you know, what is your population mix? You know, what do you have in your communities? And the Michigan area, there's a large Middle Eastern community there. You know, that have come
where?
From the Middle East in the Michigan area,
okay.
Detroit, I think, primarily. So you see these kind of factors that I think the federal government's examining, saying, well, where's our biggest threat? You know, where do we have, you know, nuclear plants? Where do we have, you know, certain things that would really be dangerous? And that's probably going to weigh heavily on how they decide this money is going to be
parceled out. It's still an all-hazards approach. Terrorism is a component to it, but the natural disasters, and unfortunately, off the coast, we have the Cascadia. And so there is some unfortunately.
So that's a great analogy there, Colonel.
There are some potentially some factors that exist, and FEMA is putting in some good dollars to help us produce that regional plan. But FEMA, DHS, they're going to look at it from a holistic standpoint. What is it going to take for the entire community in order to get them to respond and recover from disaster XYZ?
Do they take into account at the local level gangs and drugs?
Generally not, Senator Morris Anderson.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, because at the Homeland Security Council that last year, I mean, the nationwide cut is between 32% and 52%. They're just, the whole nation's being cut. And then what's left is what they're talking about here. So across the nation, we're seeing almost a halving completely. There's only half as much money available, and then it falls into the category. So everybody's suffering across the board.
But once we're getting, once we start getting out of the war, what does that mean? I mean, they won't shore up some money that we're not spending in combat to security?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, I think the two are obviously connected. But I think we've got a different world since 9/11, and I think that we clearly operate differently. Just when you get on an airplane, things are different than they were before that. We all know that. So I think we've moved into an area that, regardless if the war winds down, there's still going to be. There's no question if you look at the global threats that there are people out there that do not appreciate the United States of America, and they are going to continue in small cells and small groups. And that makes it even more difficult. It's much easier to really fight if you're fighting a war, if you know who your enemy is, and, you know, the World War II scenario types. That's not the world we're in now. The world we're in now is it could be a group of one or two or three. This guy was one man in Washington, D.C., and they don't even know if he had an affiliation other than getting on the Internet, you know, reading all this stuff that's on there. So I don't think they've proven that yet, and they may not prove it. But that's what we're dealing with, unfortunately, and it's a needle in a haystack. And I think we as American citizens are going to pay a tremendous amount of money in the future just to keep ourselves safe, to keep this country safe. And that's really discouraging when you look at all the money we spend on these wars and say, well, gee, if we weren't spending that, we could put it into education, roads, bridges, you name it. Unfortunately, I think there's not going to be a victory parade. It's more like the Cold War went on for 30 years, and I think we've migrated into this new form of Cold War, if you will, and I think that's what we're going to see. And we spent billions of dollars in the United States building up to combat against the Cold War over a 30-40 year period, and I think that's where we're at, unfortunately.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the observation that we've heard on the floor, I mean, the federal government's borrowing 40% of every dollar it's spending right now, so they've got to figure that one out first. Before you gentlemen go, I mean, the only other topic that came up at the end of last session that we punted back to the Ways and Means was the Christmas Valley project. And if you recall, Madam Vice Chair, we were asked to look at it and see, did it strategically make sense? And I think we made the recommendation back that if it was financially wise, it was strategically wise and of military value. And unless either of the two of you want to hear it, I mean, we could have them talk about where the Christmas Valley project is, or we could just go on and end the meeting. It's up to you.
I could certainly give you just a short few minutes on it if you're interested in that.
Committee members? Quick, yeah.
Actually, I had handed out to you in your packet, I think you should have a document that looks something like this. It's called the Oregon Army National Guard Net Zero Newsletter. Christmas Valley folds into this initiative. I think we briefed this committee on it, but just for a quick review. The Net Zero Project, the Department of Defense is the largest consumer of energy in the world as one entity. You may have heard the President in his State of the Union message talk about energy and he used the military as the example that he's going to hand the ball to them to see, basically he wants to see progress. Because of our selection of the only National Guard entity in the United States to be put into this pilot program from the Department of the Army, we believe Christmas Valley holds a very important piece of that if the conditions do come to the right level of fiscal responsibility. As you may recall, Christmas Valley is a 2,600-acre site situated just outside of Christmas Valley in south-central Oregon. And this site is 2,622 acres in total. It's the former home of the Cold War backscatter radar site, which was an Air Force operation. We currently have about 360 acres that we received through a FEMA grant with three warehouses, some infrastructure, and our plan was to, thinking of the Cascadia again, kind of putting both hats on, is this is where if we could get the federal government to fund it, we would put supplies, we would put shelters, this sort of thing at Christmas Valley, because we can fly our CH-47 helicopters in there, land them, load it up, and get over the mountain to the coast if we needed it. So we sought those warehouses primarily for that purpose. It's isolated. After we received that, after we got that grant from the FEMA, we also recognized, and I spoke of military operating areas or places to fly our jets out of Klamath Falls. This is about a 5-minute jet ride from Klamath Falls, or maybe 3 minutes, depending on what piece where you have your throttle. And we train our pilots with ground emitter radars, which basically they'll be flying in this airspace doing maneuvers. There's about a pickup. If you can visualize a pickup with an apparatus in the back of it or a trailer, you can sit it out here on this land, and then electronically or remotely you can key a signal that goes up in the air that says I'm shooting a surface-to-air missile at this plane, and then the pilot has to react against it, so it's electronic signaling. We saw this as an opportunity, again, for training purposes, to bring those apparatuses in there and station them around that 2,600 acres, because our folks are flying over it and they're training. The third thing we recognized was that it had a tremendous infrastructure. It got essentially 100 megawatts of pipeline power lines coming to that site. And we thought, why can't, and the legislature also here 5-6 years ago, maybe a little longer, came up with a 1.5% for solar that you may be familiar with. In fact, there's this bill in this session, I think, is going to modify that a bit. So every state capital construction project has to have 1.5%, solar. So we said, well, this makes sense. Why don't we look at this as a place where everybody could buy solar, put it in this 100 megawatt pipeline. We get more sun. It's one of the most solar adaptive sites in Oregon. So maybe we start looking at a 2,600 acre solar farm of some sort or some variation of that. So we began, we went work with the Department of Energy. We received some ARRA grants from them to actually do two things. One was to do a feasibility study that was just completed. It's being finalized. It's 99% done. Secondly, we received some money from the Department of Energy to put up solar panels on those three buildings, about 250 kilowatts, I think, or something of that nature. I've got it in here somewhere. It's in this report, but... in the meantime, we started working with private industry. And private industry, since we didn't own the 2,600 acres, General Services Administration did. We started working with them on a cost of what it would take to get it out of their hands and get it to the state of Oregon. And we also started looking at private industry and asking questions and working with BPA to say, is this feasible to put something down here on an industrial scale with private industry doing the construction, bringing in the 1.5% for solar and what I termed a solar bank, which there's several people have been interested in that here. Instead of putting three panels on this building when you do a remodel, take the money, put it in a bank when you get something that's large enough, then go establish it there. But that will only work, in my opinion, and basically what we learned, if we get a private industry partner. As you also know, this legislature changed those tax benefits for those energy projects. The federal government did the same here in the last couple of years, and what we're learning is that now with those changes, private industry is not very interested in doing that sort of large industrial scale type operation. So presently where we sit is that the General Services Administration's asking a little over $1 million for the other 2,600 acres or 2,300 acres. We don't have a buyer, a contractor or somebody who could come in and assist us in this kind of overarching strategic look. And unless things changes, unless things change dramatically in the next 6 or 8 months, we're probably going to back away from that and just deal with the 300 acres that we have. Or go back to GSA and say you're overpricing this thing because without these tax benefits, there's no interest. The infrastructure's there. Makes logical sense. Wouldn't take a lot to do it, but it's going to take some serious effort on the part of some outside entity, whether that be, and we're encouraging the Army to look at this as a place to replace energy, or the Air Force at Klamath Falls, and also through our armories. Presently, we spend a lot of money. I think it's about $2.5-3 million of state money to pay for energy. Most of the energy is paid for by the federal government. It's about a 70-30 split in that arena. So we're spending a lot of money in the Oregon National Guard and the Oregon Military Department for electricity. Anything we can do to lessen that footprint to our advantage, but without some significant investment either from the Department of the Army or an outside entity, I don't see the state being able to handle that. So there's more to come. We're still engaged with two different private contractors or private entities because they still have interest. And is it in our best interest to do that? We're going to have to sort that out. We have one proposal. The other one says they're going to propose. I can tell you now from the proposal that I've seen, this won't pencil out. As quick as we get somebody who's serious and we can sit down and talk to them, then we can build a financial model that we can bring back to this, to the legislature, and say this will work, or this, or we'll just scrap it. So that's kind of where we're at in the Christmas Valley operation.
Any comments, member?
I find it interesting, all the little things you're having people do. Turn off the lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moses Anderson,
shut the door.
Exactly. I keep telling our folks I'm going to come up with a sign that says, "Your mother doesn't work here. Shut out the light." You know, I mean, it's.
But see, we all remember 1973 and the oil embargo, and President Nixon puts out these little things. The federal government provided these little squares to put over your light switches. Remember, they said, yeah, Turn the light switch off? All that stuff came out of there. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Appreciate it, gentlemen. If you'll just kind of stand fast temporarily.
Just recess for a minute while you tell me what's going on.
Okay, we're not going any place, and I'll explain in a minute here. Why don't you tell us what we're going to do here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's a need for conflict amendments on the measure that was just moved. That's Senate Bill 4063 with the A7s. Andrew sent in a request for conflict. That means there's some other measure that's moved that they can't do. They can't both go. So
we're going to stand at ease for a few minutes while Elsie and those people move.
Legislative Council is seeing if the drafter, Marissa James, can be here to explain the alternatives. It's a policy decision what the committee might want to do, and they have an idea how to go about it. And if the committee can stay and make that decision, they can draft the amendments. You can recess, reconvene at 1 o'clock, and have the document potentially in front of you at that time without going to the president's office and requesting an additional hearing. The reason this is because is today's the last day to move.
Right, we don't want an additional hearing. We've had that. So
I'd rather just recess.
Yeah, we'll stand at recess.
the meeting, if you'd like to explain to us what we've done wrong.
Chair Boquist, you didn't do anything wrong. I'm Marisa James from Legislative Council. And so it looks like you have a conflict coming up between a bill that fixes some things for the Board of Medical Imaging and which is already passed, mm-hmm. and the new bill allowing boards to consider military experience.
And the other bill number is House Bill 4008, is that
yes,
right?
4008 is the Board of Medical Imaging's bill. So in that bill, you're allowing the Board of Medical Imaging, or in your bill, you're allowing the Board of Medical Imaging to consider military experience, mm-hmm. which works until 2014, when under House Bill 4008, an applicant for a license issued by the Board of Medical Imaging has to hold a credential issued by a credentialing organization. So your military experience is irrelevant once that comes into effect, because you just have to hold a credential.
That was Mitch's bill.
Mitch Greenlee.
He just passed it out of my committee, health committee.
Okay.
So your options, in 2014, you could get rid of the section allowing the Board of Medical Imaging to consider military experience.
No.
I suppose we could put something like, I don't know if would the military issue a credential of some kind, or we could put holds a credential or, you know, has military experience that the board determines is adequate.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Bill, what do you want to do?
Yeah, I think that, I would think the intent of the legislature from this bill anyway, that we would want to have the Board of Imaging to look at the experience in the military rather than so somehow adding something that would say looking at military experience.
Okay, yeah, I mean, yeah. I can draft that amendment.
I mean,
yeah, I'm fine. I'm just
you know, this bill actually came from 4008 came from a committee bill on or
from the healthcare committee, you said?
Yes, on the House
side.
I think so too.
As long as the language was consistent with the discretion that's in the measure that you all passed.
That we passed here.
It's discretion to the board whether to consider.
Yes.
So what we want to do is have them prepare an amendment from the bill that we just talked about for 4063 to stick in there to make sure we fix the 2014.
Yeah.
Right, so that'll be a conflict amendment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I was supposed to ask you, well, I can maybe ask Cheyenne that question later. I don't think I'm not sure what the question is at this point, so I think I'm okay.
I'd rather not. Are you still in recess?
No, we're not.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so you'll get conflict amendments to that effect then.
Okay.
Okay, let's just stand at recess for 1 second and don't go any further, okay?
Yeah.
Sorry, so what's up?
The Committee on Veterans Military Affairs will come back to order. Okay, Council, you've had a second Council discussion here, so explain to us how we're going to, how the conflict amendment you think would work so that you can get guidance from the Vice Chair.
Yeah, Chair Boquist and Vice Chair Bonas Anderson, I think what we discussed just previously will work if we retain this holds a credential and then give another option, or you know, the applicant has military experience, whatever this says in 4063, as determined by the board by rule, that's adequate. Right. So I think that will work.
So it's permissive to the board?
Yes, which okay. It already is here. Yeah, the board has discretion to determine what the adequate military experience and training is.
And since you're the only one knowledgeable of the other bill, do you think that will work, Madam Munsher?
Yes, as long as in 4009 did it say you had to have a licensing agency, I mean, this would override that.
Yes, Chair Boquist. Okay. Yeah, Senator Bonas Anderson. Yes, you had to have a credential issued by a credentialing. Yes, so that would give another option besides the credential issued by the agency if you have military training that's adequate.
Okay, so this, just so that I understand, so the conflict amendment would address the issue that we want a veteran who has medical imaging experience in the military to be able to have the board have discretion on allowing them to be licensed under
yes.
the Board of Medical.
That's right.
Okay, I think, yeah.
Okay, so we're having. Okay, so for the record, what we're going to do is we're going to recess till 1 o'clock, and at 1 o'clock, we're going to come back for a very short amount of time for the purpose of a work session for HB 4063 to add a conflict amendment to that bill, deconflicting it with House Bill
4008.
House Bill 4008. So we're on the record for that, and with that, committee members, we are in recess till 1 o'clock in this room.
Thank you.